Hey everybody, welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host Ryan Krause, coming at you for part 5 of the Delphi Murders. Now, in the previous episodes, I talked about a symbolic rebirth narrative involving the perpetrator in this case. And so now, we come to an interesting element that will elaborate upon those previously laid out ideas. And that comes in the form of the shack. At the 2019 press conference, Indiana State Police Superintendent Doug Carter spoke passionately about having seen a movie called The Shack, and mentioned that there's also a book. Not surprisingly, The Shack is about a man who undergoes a symbolic rebirth in emotional darkness, during which he meets three figures you might very well recall from the narrative I laid out earlier, which are the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, or Holy Spirit. The protagonist in The Shack encounters them each in human form. Now, you'd have to imagine the reason he undergoes this journey is because he's emotionally stuck somewhere, trapped in a cycle due to something that happened in the past. Now, we learn when he was 13, he was abused by an alcoholic father and is later unable to reconcile those horrors against a peaceful reality in his adult life because part of him, meaning that child, still haunts his emotional life. He must find a way to bring peace to that child within, aka to kill it. Now, we know that since this is a narrative about being stuck back in childhood, that theme of staying afloat, or floating, aka suspension, between the universe and the light above, meaning our rational mind, and the dark mirror universe of the unconscious mind below, by way of some type of bridge, is going to be relevant. Here it is. When this man, our protagonist, has kids of his own, and takes them camping, they go out onto a canoe one day. The boat tips and the kids fall into the water. The father scrambles to keep them afloat, but ironically, one of the children has been left back on the shore and goes missing. He searches for this missing girl, but no trace of the kid is found. During his journey through the meetings with the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, he comes to learn that the body of the missing child is actually hidden in a nearby shack and always has been. The protagonist merely needs to take other people to that place to show them the truth, physically. Now, of course, the shack is a metaphor for the head or mind or brain, the place in which this dead child in the story resides and haunts him. It isn't until the protagonist willingly leads authorities and loved ones to this place that they learn the truth. Again, it's a metaphor about taking people to the place in your head where the child you once were died because he couldn't stay afloat in adulthood due to having one foot anchored down in childhood, which manifests the potential for drowning we see in the story. Desperation to stay afloat and anxiety about being a father who can't teach his kids to do the same because of what he suffered by the hands of his dad before that. But the healing comes when this man finally tells them that the truth about the dead child is in the shack, and they go there to find the kid once and for all. He gets the catharsis he needs, and so does everybody else. The truth. And we know it brings healing by way of the symbolism involved, because he's in a hospital when it happens. The bottom line is that he brought the truth to light, specifically by identifying that the problem, or the dead child, was in the shack, his head, and not somewhere out in the material world waiting. That child had long since been dead. He had only hoped the truth was something different. Before he changes emotionally, the only trace of the child is torn fabric and blood, meaning death is insinuated, but hope remains, in the same way an abused child who becomes a man-child holds on to desperate hope that they can still save their inner child from an imminent fate. When he invites people into the shack, or his head, the truth is revealed in the form of the dead child, and emotional healing ensues, followed by symbolic rebirth as the father takes the child's body into a cave, aka dark womb. And of course, the metaphor of the shack as the brain is saying that this is the kind of condition that his mind is in right now. It's not very good. So Doug Carter mentioning this movie and the book at the press conference in 2019 is a way of addressing the killer to say, hey, we know why you did this, and the right thing to do, the way to start healing, is through admitting the truth. In The Shack, when the protagonist undergoes this process and finally deals with this emotionally, what happens is that he confronts his father apologizes, and healing begins through that channel as well. So again, in that story, the protagonist is the one who tells them where the dead child is. Here, we have the same circumstance. The dead children in the material world are manifestations of the emotional life of the killer. Quite simply, Carter is imploring this person to indulge that level of sympathy, as it's the only way for all parties involved to heal. And do you remember how the father and son cycle has the father on top with the son on bottom? At that press conference, we only see two people on screen at the time Carter is speaking, and they are very much strategically arranged. Now, in Indiana, in 2019, Superintendent Carter would have been the top cop, so to speak. In the context of law enforcement in that state being family, we could say he is the equivalent of the father. On screen, Sheriff Tobe Lesenby is made to stand there in silence with his hands behind his back, obscured and again silenced by a more powerful man playing the role of the father and marginalizing him. We all know of the saying, children should be seen and not heard. That is exactly what they did to him at that press conference, despite the fact that he is in charge of that investigation. Lesenby is present the entire time Carter is out there and is relegated to being in the background, specifically behind Carter, not speaking, being overshadowed by the man, and then made to follow Carter off stage at the conclusion of the speech, again, without ever saying a word, in total silence. He is only seen, and he is not heard. Carter stands over him as a taller man, intentionally marginalizing him in silence in the background. I know when I see cops fucking with somebody, and I believe a very loud message was being sent to the sheriff at the time. Lesenby is supposed to be in charge of the investigation, aka supposed to be the father, or top cop in this case, and he is excluded from participating completely. I think that was an intentional insult, and I believe the hiding in plain sight comments were directed at him. Not because I have insight beyond what the rest of the general public does, but because there's a video showing the killer head to toe in broad daylight, and that killer, to my eyes, more than any other suspect, by far, looks like Sheriff Tobe Lesenby. Again, I have no interest in pointing the finger at someone. I just want to know why. Why does the killer look like the sheriff? Why aren't we indulged with close-ups of the perpetrator's face or alternative angles? I can tell you, because I've studied those images, as bad as some of them are. The reason is they all look like him. Again, it's possible he's not the guy. It might be somebody completely different. But while having more evidence than we do, law enforcement still made him a suspect. There are rumors his polygraph was inconclusive. It doesn't make him a killer, but there is clearly a lack of transparency at play here. The Shack is about a father of three with a daughter, right? And of course, what they're saying is, what if it was your daughter? And so, the person to whom they are probably speaking is likely a father of three who has a daughter, and, again, Sheriff Tobe Lesenby is a father of three who has a daughter. So, along with the other elements, there's clearly reason to believe that he is being addressed at this press conference. That isn't to say they aren't addressing anybody else. We also know that they made a comment about shifting gears in the investigation. And of course, when I first heard that, I didn't know who Tony Klein was, but I heard that a family member of one of the victims worked at some sort of automotive plant, and so I wondered if there was some sort of connection, if only briefly. As time passed, and we came to know who Tony Klein was, supposedly, he actually worked at some type of automotive plant in which he works with transmissions, and so that comment might have been directed at him. Law enforcement obviously does directly communicate to the perpetrator, but if it's in a case in which they don't know exactly who the perpetrator is and they have a narrow list of suspects, often what will happen is that you will get a mixed message in which you don't really have a lot of clarity, and it's probably because they're speaking to more than one person. And I think we see that here with the nature of the sketches and the mentioning of the shack. There's something that doesn't quite align here in the sense of this only being one person that they were looking at in 2019. If I had to guess, I would say that they were probably both addressing Sheriff Tobe Lesenby and Keegan and Tony Klein. But of course, that's speculation. We don't know. I think the one thing I would say is that I don't believe the mention of the shack has anything to do with Tony Klein. So all efforts made by law enforcement since the initial release of the sketch have obviously done what they could to alleviate the notion that the sheriff and the man in the video bear a striking resemblance. It's never mentioned. The flyers seeking information all show a young man, perhaps even a boy, with bushy hair. All frames of the killer standing with his legs perfectly straight or together are avoided because you can actually see the thickness of his thighs and his waist. You can see the shape of his legs. Or his mustache that matches the one the sheriff had at the time. Perfectly. In other frames, the only ones law enforcement seems interested in promoting, movement creates angles that foreshadow a thinner, taller man. They are desperate to avoid this man appearing like the 5 feet, 6 inch, overweight, middle-aged man he really is, the one the witness described seeing by the Freedom Bridge. Tony Klein is taller than that. The video shows us a middle-aged man. The witness says he matched the description of Bridge Guy, and that he was 5 feet, 6 inches tall. And Bridge Guy looks just like the sheriff. And while I don't know exactly how tall the sheriff is, if I had to guess, that's exactly what my guess would be. 5'6". This is a problem. Unless you're in charge of the investigation, then it doesn't seem to be a problem at all. And the case remains unsolved into perpetuity, going from one suspect to the next. Here's the truth involved. You can't catch a killer if you've excluded him from suspicion. Have they? I don't know. Or do they not have the evidence necessary? I believe he's the guilty party. Some people agree, many don't. I believe other members of law enforcement know it. I could be wrong, but I would be willing to bet they know about the truth inside this guy's shack from the fact that he's local, that people know the family, that there have been rumors. I'm willing to bet on the inside, this thing is actually quite simple. Except it's not, because suspicion is not evidence. It is not truth. If the sheriff is guilty and there's no accompanying physical evidence to prove it, the result you should expect is, well, exactly what's happening. The case is tumbling around like a load of laundry, caught in a never-ending cycle, and poisoned by a father-son narrative that's causing a major distraction. In order for that abusive state to cease, someone has to step in and stop the cycle. That isn't going to happen if the source of the cycle starting is the same as the one charged with ending it. I believe that is why we have been given, primarily, father and son sketches, so to speak, so that we, as the public, can also suffer the same fallout of having to cycle back and forth between the father and the son without definitively ever being able to transcend. If we're trapped in the abusive cycle with the killer, we'll understand what he endured. That's what he wants. Everyone to suffer what he did, so they'll finally understand what it's like, and the absence of him having the courage to open up and invite them inside his shack to see the corpse of his childhood. That's why Superintendent Carter labeled the killer a coward in the 2019 press conference. They wanted to get him to take them to that place inside his head. They were trying to implore empathy, because this is a man they believe is capable of it. It's his path to redemption, taking them to the shack, taking them to the truth. And the place where that truth resides is inside his head. And, of course, the way they're trying to do it is through a narrative involving a father of three losing his daughter. Who do you think they're speaking to? In that moment, the sheriff is in the body of a man and under the facade of being in charge of this investigation, but marginalized and silenced in the background like an abused child letting dad create the narrative in the absence of his input. I think they did it to him intentionally. He's the much shorter man and a professional subordinate, the number two, so to speak, to Carter's one, like father and son, in that moment. And what colors the more powerful man wearing? Blue. What does Bridge Guy wear? Blue. That's what he wants. That's why Carter says, "This is about power to you." Carter looks like a father admonishing a child, and only once does he make a sudden physical movement, an aggressive lean out to his right with his hand raised. Sheriff Lesenby is standing directly in that spot where his hand goes. He's talking about the killer wanting power while keeping the shorter, less powerful sheriff hidden behind him in second place, silent like an abusive father to a son. This speech reeks of behavioral practices employed by the FBI. I'd almost guarantee they wrote the better part of what he said. But if you're the killer, you know any attempt to lure you into doing the right thing by way of empathy means one thing. They don't have shit. And here we are. Like all of us and our opinions, they might know who did it, but if there isn't evidence, well, no one can say for sure. It's just my opinion, but I think Carter unleashed tough talk at that press conference in 2019 because it was likely all they had. They didn't have any physical evidence beyond that, at least in terms of definitive physical evidence like DNA and so forth. They obviously know that we're dealing with someone who was abused by his father at the same age the girls were when he attacked them. And if that isn't apparent enough in the psychology of the narrative, then Carter going full blast over the top and mentioning the shack makes it abundantly clear. Again, I don't think they were addressing Tony Klein in that narrative. It doesn't seem like one that would resonate with him. I recall that Keegan said he was an only child, but again, Keegan Klein seems to lie about everything, so who's to say? I really don't know. So being abused at that age prevented him from going up the hill into adulthood emotionally because it left him with one foot back in childhood and one in adulthood, straddling the growing gap between until he fell into the void and descended to a darkness from which he could never return. He died on that hill, going up that hill, emotionally, after crossing into adulthood because he still had one foot planted firmly back in childhood on the other side of the creek, symbolized by Libby's sneaker in the mud. It was the child inside him who caused him to die there. Having one foot back in the past, again, left him stuck, suspended, not floating, not weightless, but crumbling under a burden. He needed to finally force that child across the creek into adulthood, so to speak, and because he couldn't do it emotionally, he finds a physical landscape to match his emotional needs. If a painter wants to say something about life, then they create images to assemble their thoughts. Likewise, when the shoe is found, undoubtedly the first thing noticed about it is what? That Libby isn't wearing it. That whatever child had been wearing that shoe which was stuck in the mud had finally left that spot. That's what the killer is doing, forcing the circumstances to transpire in physicality and by way of replication because he finds the issue emotionally irreconcilable. He can't go back to his childhood and fix the problem, unless he chooses to do so by psychological means. From a physical standpoint, it's gone. But the abused are often taught to be silent and feel shame to keep them quiet. That silence is often carried with them into adulthood, and they end up abusing others to cope, re-entering the cycle in the role of the father or abuser instead of the son or abused, so they can feel powerful. To a great extent, that's what's going on here. This killer is herding these children to the place he died emotionally so that he can bring perceived balance by killing them physically in that spot and with him in the role of the father, so to speak. His ability to climb that hill and be free of the child that haunts him is dependent upon it, but dependent in a physical way rather than emotional. Now, this is a sensitive subject, but let's talk about the attack itself and the crime scene. We can only speculate about these things and certainly don't want to be insensitive in that pursuit, but the nature of a double homicide in which the crime scene is more or less unknown to the public outside of locals involved in the search lends itself to quite a few rumor spreading. There's usually some truth to these types of rumors, as people in small towns talk, and many locals were, like I said, involved in the search. And then, of course, the rest is bullshit. From embellishments to lies, cases of this magnitude that become national sensations are prone to people seeking to become important by fabricating stories about things they know that others don't. Some of those things might be true, but a good bit are false. Let's approach this speculative examination in the context of what rumors are likely to be true based on the psychology. But again, it's very important to remember that anything we talk about in the context of the crime scene is more or less a rumor. Now, like I said earlier, the location of the crime scene is very specific. The perpetrator died emotionally going up that hill, so the victims will die there physically to create balance. It means we should expect to see elements of being at peace in death, and also symbolic rebirth present where the killings took place. These dead children need to represent the killer's childhood symbolically dying, as well as his subsequent rebirth into adulthood as the father. Other than that potential slip down the hill, I don't see this event as one that got out of control, meaning that the girls went running all over the place and had to be corralled. Even if the perpetrator made a small miscue, it is more than evident that he did exactly what he intended to do. As far as we know, while he was caught on video, nobody local to the abduction and murders reported hearing screams or even seeing the man performing these acts. The result says this act was well planned, in advance, and carried out with great efficiency. In my eyes, the perpetrator possesses specific skills related to authority and taking people into his possession. He likely maintained control throughout, even if there was difficulty in the form of a fall. Now, attacking and killing them before they can get up that hill also has another psychological component to it. Fred and Rose West would abduct girls around this age, take them back to their house of horrors on Cromwell Street, and then suspend them by their bound hands on ceiling hooks, where the victim would suffer under the burden of her own weight aka the physically manifested mirrored version of emotional weightlessness, in order to create balance due to the heavy burden that the couple, like the Delphi killer, suffered in childhood by way of abuse and caused them to become trapped in that place. So they wanted to do it to other people, just like this Delphi killer. A home, like the shack, is a brain. The dark basement is the equivalent of the unconscious mind. The stairway leading up to the first floor is the subconscious, and the light above symbolizes the conscious mind. The subconscious mind acts as the junction between the conscious and unconscious minds. It's the way in which terrible realizations rise into the light and can never go back down into the ignorance of the depths below. In the Colonel Russell Williams case, he hid in a woman's basement, attacked her, and before taking her upstairs to her bedroom, assaulted her on the stairs exactly halfway between the basement and the first floor. In practicality, it seems a really weird place, but symbolically, that staircase leading up from the basement into the light is the place from which the realization that he was emotionally a woman came, and so attacking a woman in that spot, stopping the personified version of the bad thought in its tracks, is alluring. He's preventing that thought from getting up into his rational mind. He's getting even. He's projecting the woman of his authentic emotional identity onto the victim and controlling her, keeping her stuck there, unable to ascend on the hill. It's revenge for what the woman inside him was doing to him emotionally. A woman had control over him and was rising into his conscious mind, and he was desperate to manifest a circumstance that could bring him balance. So first, he stops her, and then he takes her up the stairs, meaning that is the worst offense of all because she's now in his rational mind, and he kills her. Throughout history, hangings have been excessively popular as a means of execution, and it's because of the element of suspension. To manifest the idea of bad thoughts or realizations going back down into the unconscious mind, the perpetrator is dropped into that position of suspension, which causes a physical death to compensate for the emotional death of the offended party, such as family or friends of a criminal's victim. And of course, we see in the noose that we have the straight line combined with the circle, but it goes down rather than up, symbolically going to hell or death, the darkness below, instead of ascending or rising. The design dictates that because the family and friends of the victim will suffer in their heads under a terrible burden, the person being hanged will know that suffering physically instead to compensate. They're stuck in that position and dead physically to bring balance for the emotional death surviving friends and family suffered psychologically. A prison cell would be the equivalent without death. It suspends a person in place, but not with any degree of weightlessness, rather a heavy burden. So what perpetrators often do, even in horror movies like the ones we've discussed, is kill their victims in a way that they're suspended between two places, like the floor and the ceiling, but dying under their own weight. That's what happens to young people, like our perpetrator here once was, who can't or don't mature emotionally heading into that transition between childhood and adulthood. So in horror movies, it's usually the sinners who die and saints who live. The more responsible and adult-like you behave, the greater the chances are that you'll survive, because that's what happens in our lives. So at the end of Friday the 13th, we see the protagonist, the final girl, in a canoe. She's floating. It's emotional weightlessness. An interesting thing to notice about Leatherface iconically placing a young woman on the sharp end of a hook suspended from the ceiling is that a hook is a manifestation of the idea of being stuck climbing up the hill on the side of the circle. That's how it's shaped. The place where the sharp edge that traps its prey is located is on the way up the hill. and the circle stops there because it only needs to go that far for the prey to get stuck on it, whether we're talking about Leatherface attacking girls or we're fishing for bass. So, in this Delphi narrative, the killer only needs to escort his prey, so to speak, past the creek and onto the hill. Just like with the Hillside Strangler, right? The important thing is that the girls are going to be at the bottom of the hill and dead, while the killer is going to remain at the top, regardless of the means. So, this killer is going to kill and go up the hill, and the Hillside Stranglers, having already killed, are going to throw the body down the hill, which then creates the structure of them having ascended to the top of the hill, while the victim is at the bottom. In his mind, once they're on the hill, they're a threat to escape up into the light, like those bad thoughts in the unconscious mind of the colonel rising on the stairs. Not only is this the symbolic place where he got stuck, or died emotionally in his adolescence, meaning on the way up the hill into adulthood, but it's also the place where the child inside him, represented by Libby and by extension Abby, can escape into his rational or conscious mind above. This is the sharp edge of the hook, where the hill ends for the victims. Again, whether it's a fish getting caught on an actual hook by a fishing rod, or Leatherface killing people. So, when they reach this spot, emotionally, he needs to put the child inside him at rest. But without recourse or willingness for doing it emotionally, he projects himself onto the targeted child, who reminds him of himself at that age. While we could expect a less chaotic and perhaps more practical killing of Abby, one born more so of utility than sadistic measures, Libby is different. This is personal. I would expect Libby to have incurred more injuries, with those wounds being delivered in greater intensity and passion, so to speak. This child represents the one in his head who tortured him for so many years. So we have to remember, this is the symbolic moment in which he gets payback. He is extremely angry. Based on the David Erskine texts, which are still considered rumor but largely seem to have not been disproven, we hear that Abby suffered at least one stab wound to the heart, and her neck was slit in the area of the carotid artery, both injuries which are seemingly going to lead to death. Outside of the texts, it's rumored that Abby suffered significant head trauma. An even bolder rumor suggests she might have survived the night and tried to crawl away, but the search was called off and she proceeded to pass away. That's horrifying, but I would assume both girls died with the killer present. The Erskine texts suggested the coroner said it was all over by 3:30 p.m., and I would guess that means the victims were deceased by then. Now, Erskine's text suggested the girls were not discovered bound, but were instead posed lying next to each other, though no proximity between the bodies was offered. It doesn't mean they hadn't been bound during the crime, of course. It's just that any bindings that might have been used were no longer on the bodies. Were there handcuffs? Were there zip ties? We don't know. Now, I don't have access to the crime scene photos or information, obviously, but what's apparent to me, even from the outside, is that if bindings were used, law enforcement would know. Not only would marks on the hands or wrists indicate such, but the manner in which the victims fought back, or if they did at all, would reveal itself. They would know if they had access to their hands to defend themselves. And of course, the presence or lack of defensive wounds would be quite enlightening. This killer, again, to me, seems like someone who is a person of authority and is equipped with a significant amount of gear that is going to allow him to commit this crime with minimal risk of leaving DNA. Obviously, He can't commit a sexual assault if he wants the bodies to be found, and what is a huge risk is the possibility of being scratched, scraped, or otherwise grabbed by the victim in a way that would not only collect DNA, but leave him with an obvious defensive wound or wounds in a situation in which it would be game over as soon as either the wound or the DNA revealed him as the perpetrator. In David Erskine's texts, he suggested that it appeared Libby fought like hell. The assumption is too often made that it means she had access to her hands and was engaged in combat with the killer. I honestly don't see the man in the video being a guy who would allow such a thing to transpire. This person is highly calculated and efficient. He has a lot of gear on him. I think he is prepared to minimize the chances of any type of transfer of DNA or other such physical evidence. The psychology says he definitely wanted Libby to suffer and struggle like he did trying to get up that hill before dying. So we would expect a much greater degree of personal involvement with her from the killer as opposed to Abby. He would manifest a circumstance which replicates the abuse he suffered at that age that prevented him from going up the hill. And at the end of that abuse, as happened to him emotionally, the child dies there, physically, stuck forever. On the hook, suspended between childhood and adulthood, unable to get up that hill forever. So I think this man would have tried to create a situation in which he minimized the risk of DNA transfer through bindings such as handcuffs or even zip ties that prevented defensive wounds, and he decided to forego traditional means of sexual assault for the same reason. This isn't a guy behaving like a phantom who came in from out of town. He's behaving like he believes his DNA absolutely cannot be present at the crime scene or on the girls. He is behaving like he knows quite a bit about these types of situations. He seems to believe or even expect that he'll end up close to this case. As a result of a struggle with Libby in which it seems no definitive DNA was recovered, we would have to think that she wasn't scratching and clawing at him. I'm guessing both girls had their hands bound during the killings. Maybe not. Maybe he just used that bridge guy costume to cover himself well enough and got lucky. But I see someone interested in doing exactly what he wants and without any more risk than what is necessary. In this day and age, preventing the victims from acquiring your DNA is of the greatest importance if you want to get away with a crime. We were told that they were fast-tracking the DNA in 2017, or fast-tracking the evidence, whatever the misunderstanding might have been, and there's been no indication since then that they have any physical evidence related to the perpetrator's identity. I doubt they do. Now, from the Erskine texts, again, we learned that Abby was stabbed in the heart, allegedly, and had her carotid artery slashed, while Libby was discovered nearly decapitated from having her throat cut. Outside of those texts, rumors persist that Abby had also suffered head trauma, and I'm sure the same would be true of Libby. The list of killers who have bludgeoned their victims' heads as physically manifested revenge for what they've suffered emotionally inside their heads is endless. I imagine strangulation or suffocation was also utilized, at least on Libby, but perhaps on both girls. Asphyxiation is the physically manifested experience of feeling trapped and unable to get breathing room emotionally. And it fits perfectly with the symbolic resonance of the perpetrator being unable to let go. That's why he's doing it. He's unable to let go of something in the past. Most people like this killer grew up in a home like that. That thing is slowly suffocating him to death emotionally, so sadistic predators like this do it physically to their victims to compensate and restore balance. So if we think of this predator not being able to let go, it means he's holding on to an enormous amount of the past when he suffered as a kid. We see that burden in physical terms with Bridge Guy walking around thinking it's cool to have his coat bulging like he just shoplifted his groceries. When things build up, so to speak, there is greater pressure that needs to be released. Greater catharsis is needed. On Abby, the killer seems to choose two areas of focus in which high pressure release of redshifted light or blood will take place in the form of the heart and carotid artery on the neck. The practical purpose of these injuries being inflicted is that they're the type to guarantee death without medical help received, or often even with it. But beyond that, the killer has psychological reasons that are revealed in his choices. Clearly, if the killer was abused in his past and emotionally stuck there as that child, it's due to a broken heart. We use the concept of a broken heart because if the heart is broken, then it means there's emotional disunity. As the murderer can't bring himself to address that issue psychologically, he does so physically to manifest the result by force. He's saying his heart was broken. He suffered that disunity emotionally as a kid her age and has no way to tell us due to the code of silence in which he grew up and sadly still lives, so he stabs her in the heart to give her a quote-unquote broken heart that causes death physically instead of emotionally because it's a manifested narrative. The canvas of the material world allows him to tell his story without releasing anything emotional. He keeps the secret. He keeps the silence, right? But he tells the story from within that framework. That's his loophole for getting out. That's his loophole for telling other people. He never says a word. He just leaves breadcrumbs to the truth. He leaves a physical narrative that, in its subtext, tells the story of what happened to him and why you should care, because nobody else did. Now, the slashing of the throat is conducive to the idea of disunity between body and mind. That's what it manifests. As I said, I think Libby is the target, and Abby becomes a victim by default of her presence. So we learn that while Abby allegedly has her carotid artery slashed, the injury to Libby's neck is much worse and leaves her nearly decapitated. For the killer, Abby's death wasn't going to provide the same degree of relief as the intended target Libby. And so we see the type of killing we would expect in relation to Libby's, meaning fewer injuries and, while horrific injuries, they are, in totality, of a lesser severity than what Libby seems to have endured. By severity, I mean in the context of rage and passion and not the result. Obviously, both victims died very horribly. The Erskine texts seem to support the idea that I've promoted here, which is that Libby appeared to be the target. So, the stab to the heart is indicative of a broken heart as a child Abby's age, and the slash to the neck indicates a physical manifestation of the idea of disunity between body and mind. And of course, we just talked about that disunity, meaning the perpetrator has the mind of a child because he's still living in the past in that place, and the body of an adult. And that's what creates the disunity. The perpetrator, more concerned with getting the bulk of that release or catharsis from the target, Libby, goes on to nearly decapitate her, showing an extreme degree of physically manifested disunity between body and mind because she's the one representing him. That is what he was suffering emotionally. And that wound, of course, above all others, will release the most blood or red-shifted light, which is symbolic of the past, that which is going away. It's normally the finale, like we see in the murder of Nicole Brown Simpson, in which the killer attacks her, and then the other person too, before coming back to her and delivering the most gruesome blow of all, which is to slash Nicole's throat until head and body nearly separate. That wound, of course, caused a bloodbath at the crime scene. And that's the point, the release of the redshifted light. The killer didn't do that to Ron because Ron was not the intended target. He was a secondary target. Nicole was the primary target. He was going to get the most catharsis, the most relief, and release from doing that to Nicole rather than Ron Goldman. And so here, I believe we see that happen to Libby rather than Abby for the same reason. There is an emotional connection. Now, on that note of disunity between body and mind, in 2008, a Canadian man named Vince Lee boarded a bus and sat next to another male passenger. When the young man next to him fell asleep with headphones on, Lee revealed a big knife and repeatedly stabbed the young man in two places, the neck and the heart. They are making very calculated, if horrifying, choices. And so, this Delphi killer, like O.J. Simpson allegedly, slashes throats, even to the extent of nearly decapitating a victim. It gets the point across. But for those who are enduring greater suffering due to mental illness and locked inside a psychosis which prevents anything but symbolic physical renderings of emotional pain, we might expect to see an even greater desire to tell us just how bad that disunity between body and mind really is. That's the case with Vince Lee. He stabs the victim in the neck and chest over and over to tell us about his repeatedly broken heart and inability to find consistent unity between body and mind. But once he's able to fend off people trying to help the victim, the killer goes on to tell us how much it really hurts. He tells us the truth, and he needs to go to a great extreme to do it. As the other passengers run off the bus and form a crowd outside it, waiting for the authorities, Vince Lee severs the victim's head from the body and brings the head out for everyone else to see it. It's mind-blowing, but it's just his way of saying that there's been a complete disunity between his body and mind. He's totally lost his shit and he doesn't know how to tell anyone. So he cuts this dude's head off and shows it to them and says, hey, this is the problem. That's what happens when you're completely insane, right? Now, when a person has psychological issues that are that severe, what do we often say those issues are doing? Consuming them. So, Lee, after showing the severed head to the other bus passengers, returns to the victim and, in an effort to tell us how his problems are consuming him emotionally, he begins to cut off pieces of his flesh, meaning the victim's flesh, and eat them. Jeffrey Dahmer often did the same type of thing. He enjoyed removing heads and even had one in his refrigerator when arrested. It isn't a secret that he kept photos of at least one headless victim. The more disturbed a person is, the more disturbing the disunity between body and mind in relation to the victim will be. We see with people like Jeffrey Dahmer, who keeps a head in his refrigerator, and Vince Lee, who decapitates somebody and shows it to a crowd of people, that they are in a place where they are doing very poorly in terms of their sanity. Yet sometimes people are disturbed and they're sane. And in this Delphi case, that's what we're dealing with. So the extent to which this perpetrator is hurting is not one in which he's going to get on a bus and cut somebody's head off and show it to everybody else, but one in which he's hurting to the point that he's going to nearly decapitate his intended target, and then he is going to flee, hoping that some will find it and see it. He hasn't reached the level of psychological desperation of somebody like Vince Lee or even Jeffrey Dahmer, but he's in second place for sure. This is the type of work that you see from somebody not indulging psychosis, but more so sociopathy, psychopathy, and similar. Now, there's also a rumor that the killers seem to target Libby's lower abdomen with stab wounds, which isn't part of the Erskine text, as it's possible those wounds weren't visible due to the top half of her body supposedly being covered, if those wounds actually occurred at all. Again, these are rumors, but I'm more than willing to believe the killer would have attacked the lower abdomen, as it's the location of the womb on a woman's body. And this is actually quite common. Men do this with knives to women all the time, unfortunately. In order to understand the nature of an attack like that, we have to go back to the origin of the problem, which again is disunity. Inside the womb, mother and child are essentially one, and even have a bridge between in the form of an umbilical cord. At birth, mother is separated from child, and that cord, or bridge, is cut. There is no suspension between, at which point it collapses and disunity takes hold moving forward. The baby, while still with the mother, in most cases, is now on the outside looking in. And the older he grows, the further and farther he gets from his mother emotionally and physically in terms of independence. The gap is growing disunity. That child can never get back to his mother, and in fact, is further and farther away, like I said, all the time. He must transcend his need for her by doing the opposite of continuing to allow that gap to grow. And the way is by becoming a man and finding another woman to replace her in a romantic role. To the contrary of what happened with his mom, meaning drifting away more and more over time, this relationship allows the opposite, meaning revenge, get even. The man gets closer and closer to the woman, ultimately recreating his version of what he had in his youth by making her a mother. It brings both transcendence and balance. But when a person's childhood is corrupted by his mother, either directly through abuse or indirectly through cooperating with the child's abusive father, there's a tendency for that child to grow up with a hatred of women. And that hatred, at its core, will be for the disunity brought about when they entered this world. The cause of the origin of that pain, when manifested physically on the body, would be the lower abdomen where a fetus begins to develop into a baby. So if Libby had been viciously attacked in that area, it would have been to not only display the perpetrator's rage for the disunity his mother caused him by bringing him into this world, and or cooperating or participating in the abuse he suffered, but look what we have manifesting here. The knife is the straight line. The womb is the circle. The straight line, in this case, is killing the circle. We have that theme popping up over and over again. Something is thrusting in and out of the womb, but with the intention of bringing death rather than creation. And also symbolically, we see our evolutionary narrative. When women extract the womb through AI and become the straight line like men, that part of the body will be obsolete. Obsolescence is evolutionary death, and so that idea of killing the womb, and by extension of that, killing the concept of children, is seen on display here. It's what the killer wants because it's what the father or creator or God needs. Whether we're talking about good or evil, we are going to see our evolutionary narrative inherent within the events. At the end of the evolutionary narrative, there is only the white light of the Father. The circle has been extracted, having transformed through suffering to become a second straight line, as symbolized on the crucifix through Christ's suffering. Those straight lines, or ones, when merged, are redundant, just like the pattern 1-1 would be in binary coding, and therefore there is only room left for the singularity, or the one, God. And so that disunity between mother and child is derived from the disunity in our binary universe. We go from singularity to a binary universe, so from 1 to 1-0. And the element that is added to create that is the womb, or circle, the 0. And eventually, we will go from 1-0 to 1-1. And that's what all of this suffering is about. The disunity of a binary universe born from a singularity operates on the idea of transcendence and irony, or yes and no. It starts with a one, or singularity, and becomes disunified as a binary world, meaning 1-0. So, everything we do in the process of reverse engineering the universe back to the point of origin, or singularity, or universal truth, is done through a conduit of suffering related to extracting the circle and making the resulting pair of redundant ones a single one, or singularity. There is out, and then there is back. 1 to 1-0, 1-0 back to 1-1, and those redundant 1-1s crossed, of course, make just a 1. So at the top of the hill, in this case, the Father, or the One, the singularity, cannot be accompanied by a circle. And so, what he is doing is he is killing the circle, and even specifically by way of the womb, back on the hill. Because that circle is extracted in our evolutionary narrative. So again, whether we're looking at the symbolism inherent in evil or good, in both cases, we're going to see our evolutionary narrative present. So this Delphi killer is telling us the complete evolutionary narrative of his life. It's the story of how he became the Father. Not surprisingly, authorities describe the crime scene as non-secular, religious in nature. Our evolutionary narrative as a species is about one thing and one thing only, which is becoming the Father, the One. It's only called the Father due to the traditional context of religion and searching God as what is essentially a male entity. By the time we reach that point, the concept of man and woman will be fully obsolete due to AI, and so the Father merely references the context with which the idea began. From a structural standpoint, it would be the singularity. So, the most appropriate term, or most literal term, is the One. Again, because it's literal. It's a one. The coding that runs the universe begins as a one, and with the disunity of adding the zero in the Big Bang, which is simply the program launching, infinite patterns become possible, creating our disunified binary world in which life or evolution is becoming the singularity again by reverse engineering to universal truth. Unity is eliminating the zeros to make redundant ones, or you could say, eliminating circles with straight lines. And so we see that happen in this case. Not only are these girls, as circles, eliminated, but the womb itself is also rumored to have been attacked with a straight line. So the one is essentially killing the zero, and that is the essence of our evolutionary narrative on the way back to becoming the singularity. So in order to facilitate this type of existence, there must be a relentless evolutionary assault against anything that represents the circle or the zero. This type of case, while common in true crime as a genre, is more of a statistical rarity in society today. And especially the posing of the body's part. The posing says that he desperately needed peace and rebirth. Abby is supposedly arranged with her sweatshirt hood up and hands together in her lap in a manner that looks like she's praying, but the hands are pointed downward. I have to be honest, I'm wondering if this choice of hand placement, while seemingly posed to mimic prayer or peace, isn't just a result of the fact she'd been wearing handcuffs prior to death. Her hands seemed to be pointed down with the wrists together like they'd be wearing handcuffs. And then in another image, it almost seems as though her arms are above her head. So it's very difficult to tell, and we should probably not put a whole lot of stock into what we see because the images, quite frankly, are not very good. And like he does with Libby, he wants to manifest the idea of symbolic rebirth in the womb, but his interest in her, as we saw with the severity of wounds, isn't as great as it is with Libby. As I said earlier, the womb equates to places where we go inside to get warm. So pulling up a sweatshirt hood perfectly fulfills that idea, albeit in a somewhat lazy way. And I think that that lazy manner is probably related to the fact that Abby is simply not the target. She was an ancillary victim. Now, Libby, on the other hand, is rumored to have been stripped nude like a baby or fetus about to be born, and he covers her, supposedly, with sticks, leaves, and so forth to create the equivalent of a womb. It suffices for a womb, allowing symbolic rebirth. If she is covered, she's inside. So, what's interesting is that only the top half of the body, reportedly, is covered, while the lower half of the body is, again, rumored to be in a spread eagle pose. Of course, what we understand from this is a dual purpose. The top half of the body, being covered inside the womb, so to speak, with the sticks, branches, and leaves, is telling us that symbolic rebirth is underway. Then the bottom half, the nudity, the spread eagle aspect, is symbolic of the actual rebirth itself, right? And so the last thing the father, so to speak, the killer, is going to do, right, is he is going to leave the place in which he has just created that pose because it is symbolic of his rebirth. I also heard some suggestions that Libby might have been nearly decapitated by a garrote that was extremely tight, rather than a traditional blade. And that idea, if true, would simply combine the idea of being slowly suffocated emotionally over time until it caused disunity between body and mind by leaving your mind in childhood and body in adulthood. What these killers are saying, such as the Delphi killer here and in the Nicole Brown Simpson case, is that they are hanging on by a thread, trying to live with this disunity between their bodies and minds. In the case of people like Dahmer and Vince Lee, they're not hanging on by a thread. They have lost their minds. There is complete disunity, and so they're showing it to you. Dahmer has a head in his refrigerator. And what does that say? What do you do to things that are in your refrigerator? You consume them. So he is manifesting the idea of his brain consuming him by having someone's head in his refrigerator. Same thing goes with Vince Lee. Here he is, enduring this psychosis, has no way to get out of it, no way to tell anybody what's wrong. And he says, you know what? Fuck it. I'm just going to cut somebody's head off. And that way, you're going to see that I have literally lost my mind, right? There is a complete disunity between my body and mind, and I don't know what I'm doing, and I need help. Strangely enough, Vince Lee got that help, and he's a free man today. Apparently, he has not committed another crime of that sort, because through that act, he was able to tell them what was wrong, and they were able to medicate him in a manner that corrected those issues. I'm sure that's not the case for most people, but it is more than apparent that he cut this person's head off to say, essentially, I have lost my fucking mind. And people noticed. He got the help. I don't recommend doing that. So, you know. But anyhow, Nicole Brown Simpson is left with her head barely attached, but for a bit of a bridge between the two that remained. The killer left that little bit of a bridge. here in this case in Delphi, allegedly, and also with Nicole Brown Simpson, instead of taking the head completely off. Again, what they're trying to tell us is that they're barely able to connect the two, meaning the child still living inside them, or the mind, and the adult in the mirror, or body, are disunified. They can barely keep these identities connected, and so we see it manifested in the crime. They don't have an emotional outlet for telling us, because they've been conditioned to do otherwise. So again, with Vince Lee and Jeffrey Dahmer, who had succumbed to deeply disturbing mental illnesses and were essentially incompetent by the end, the heads were severed. The unity between their bodies and minds was gone. It had consumed them. And so what did they do to cope? They literally consumed their victims, not only to bring themselves comfort, but to tell us what was wrong. The killer in this case, like the person who nearly decapitated Nicole Brown Simpson, is someone who is still hopeful to attain that desired connection between mind and body. OJ's dad left when he was 5 and had just gotten out of leg braces that left him unsure if he would ever be able to run. Once dad left, though, at age 32, after announcing he wanted to dress like a woman and live with another man, OJ started running. And never stopped. He put that number 32 on his jersey and ran right into adulthood with that man still chasing him, lurking over his shoulder. He was still that kid running from the truth, but in a man's body. And when he could run no more and the demons caught up, he needed to release the red-shifted light by extracting the zero using the straight line of the one knife. OJ's version of going up the hill or ascension after killing the mother or zero or circle was to literally get on a flight and ascend into the air. It's all about transcendence, about rising above your problems. OJ's top of the hill was on a flight out of LA, the place where he left the dead body at the bottom of that hill, the trajectory of the plane going up into the air. People who create these types of narratives have hope. People like Vince Lee in 2008, who was decapitated and begun eating his victim, is not very hopeful. Jeffrey Dahmer, masturbating to the picture of a headless young man he killed, doesn't speak very strongly of hope either. But people like OJ, who succeeded in great measure in society, and the killer in this case, who I believe most closely fits the profile of a person in law enforcement, are the types of killers still holding on to their public personas because they're worth it. Plain and simple. I think the Delphi killer is a respected member of the community. I think he genuinely believed these murders would cure him and that once they were over, he could go back to living that life reborn. This killing is just a manifested microcosm of the story of Jesus transcending to become God, but based in the context of the failure of one man to transcend his own father. He takes the victims, projected as him, down the hill to do the Jesus, aka sun part again, redoing his youth symbolically, before ascending the hill to the top, reborn as God or the Father. It's an evolutionary narrative packaged as a biblical story that is really, at its bottom line, a tragic tale about a grown man emotionally stuck in childhood, while his body has long since proceeded into the adult realm. Going up the hill at the end is just, again, the manifested equivalent of Jesus emerging deified as God. He is risen, quite literally, in this sociopathic narrative. He goes to the top of the hill. It's just a story about a dude that can't get over his father's abuse, and it cost two little girls their lives because he couldn't cope. In our evolutionary narrative, the mother and son give way to the father. He was using Libby as both himself and the mother, so her top half is covered as a womb, symbolic of the rebirth that he's about to undergo, and the bottom is spread eagle to symbolically suggest she's the mother who was sacrificed in this rebirth of Jesus becoming God, or this perpetrator finally becoming the father. In our evolutionary narrative, the womb is extracted, or the circle, or women as a sex, in favor of androgyny and deified AI. So the perpetrator stabs her in the area of the womb with a straight line, aka knife, to represent the death of the circle or womb in favor of it becoming a straight line. It symbolizes equality. The perpetrator's knife blade acts as a bridge or straight line, aka the singularity, that causes the disunity on her body. So as a man stands there, meaning the killer, with the straight line of the knife, or bridge, he, like the creator using the Big Bang to make the singularity a disunified binary universe of life, manifests the opposite to use that straight line to manifest a disunified binary universe of death. Like a penis going back and forth until a climax of creation of life, the knife does the opposite. It thrusts back and forth until a climax of death. Blue shifted light is creation, what's coming. Red shifted light, or blood, is what's going. So Bridge Guy is dressed in all blue, or at least the blue jeans and blue coat, and releasing blood all over the place in an effort to manifest the nature of change or transcendence. Blue and red shifted light at their highest pitch merge in the middle and make something new. That's what he's doing here. He is merging that red shifted light, which is going away or dying, with him, the blue shifted light, which is coming at it. Now, normally, that's something new that's going to be made at the end of our evolutionary narrative, like it is with the semen we discussed earlier, will be the transparency of white light. And so, the universe goes from total darkness of ignorance to total enlightenment, or transparency, when the bookends of the color scale merge into white. All darkness or evil or ignorance will have been eliminated. That's perfection. And then the light goes off. Everything goes back to total darkness. Then the Big Bang acts like a light switch to turn it back on. It's just electricity creating low-frequency vibrations converting to sound, and finally light, to make the images you see before your eyes that are compiled into stories rigged for a dramatic expression through vibratory inner consciousness called emotion. Things move inside you to create feeling, and the moving pictures outside have been designed to accommodate a visualization of that specific feeling, which is why every narrative from this double homicide to the last movie you watched leaves us with a desire for one thing. Unity. We want to become whole again. And so that means the destination for any story, whether this murder mystery or the question of the creator's identity, no matter how it is reached, can be one place and one only. The truth. And that is what we see represented at this crime scene physically, because the perpetrator could not tell us emotionally. Okay, so I'm going to cut it off right there for this week, and I will be back with you next Tuesday for part 6. Thank you very much for joining me.